back on the Cannabis Corner. My name is Lucas Barfield. I am a local Tacoma cannabis activist, researcher, and educator. And I am joined by my co-host, Uncle Dig, who is a veteran medical cannabis activist and podcaster out of Oregon. How are you doing today, Uncle Dig?
I'm doing great, Lucas. It's getting a little colder, and I'm enjoying the fruits of my labor from this past harvest.
Yeah, it's great to have you back on the show. We've missed a couple weeks here. Both of us have had, I've had a cold, and I know you had couple issues you had to deal with, but we are back on it on the Cannabis Corner here, and we are kind of wrapping up our fourth season, Dig. And I just want to give a couple shout outs and thank yous first. And first, I'd like to thank you for being a part of the show this year.
You're welcome. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and then I got to make sure that I thank the producer of the show, Aaron Falsch. And they have a band, the Fantastic Flying Falsches, so check them out. He's the guy who always does the final mastering. And I told him I would thank him every show, and I've been kind of thanking him every other show. So I just want to make sure that we give a great shout out and thank you to Aaron Falsch for making the show sound great, and all the guests that have been on this year. And I really got to thank the audience out there who has given me feedback. I here and there around town, people are like, oh, we like the show. So and we have a great 2022 coming up, Dig.
I'm so excited for the next year. And yeah, especially thank you to our audience. Thank you to the radio stations that host us. It's been really a really fun experience to be a part of the show.
Oh, yeah, and I definitely got to thank Radio Tacoma and KTQA for hosting the show. And KTQA is now going to have this on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 8 p.m. I'm not sure when that switch is coming, but it's coming soon. So we're kind of going to get a little more of a primetime slot, and that's really cool. And I'll be getting together a podcast coming out soon. So really exciting year coming up here in 2022. It's going to be an exciting year in cannabis, Dig. What's your prediction? So give us a prediction real quick. What do you think might happen in 2022?
Well, 2022 is midterms, right? So everyone's going to be wrangling over those wedge issues, right? Cannabis, abortion's dead in the water, a couple other things, gun control might be big. But here's what I think is going to happen for cannabis. At some point, because every year I keep saying, oh, you know, no one in the South is going to legalize. And then every time, like, I know that Oklahoma is sometimes considered the South, sometimes not. They did medical. And then I think recently Virginia is legalizing. So it's like, so my prediction is going to go against all my other predictions. I'm going to say a Southern state that is traditionally anti-cannabis is going to legalize. And it's going to surprise everybody because that's what has happened every year since this train started rolling. So I'm going to be optimistic, and I'm going to say somewhere that is traditionally anti-cannabis, a red state in the South is going to legalize cannabis. That's what I'm going to say.
Yeah, so I kind of predict something similar. I think Florida will legalize. Unfortunately, I kind of see maybe a little backsliding a little bit, especially out here in the West with the story we just saw with Oregon passing $25 million for cannabis enforcement down in your neck of the woods. And we don't have that story today, but some really big things coming up in cannabis. Hopefully that I'm wrong. I think, like I said, I think the adult use system is going to try and crack down a little more on the underground market using law enforcement. And that is an issue, I think. So let's hope I'm wrong. And I want to mention real quick, Dig, we have a guest coming on, Robert Beasley, who is the CEO of Fluent, a Florida-based dispensary chain.
Oh, awesome.
All right, so let's get into our news, and we're going to start out this week in the South, and we're going to start in St. Louis, Missouri. And this story kind of took me aback, Dig. What happened in St. Louis is the mayor and the city council, they have passed a sweeping bill basically decriminalizing cannabis. They no longer let cops search you or arrest you for cannabis smell. And the one thing that I really found fascinating is besides allowing you to have 2 ounces now, they actually decriminalized growing 6 plants.
Yeah, and I think a really cool thing about this is additionally, the law prohibits police from using the odor as a probable cause for warrantless searches. So they can still get a warrant, so don't go over your limit. But I think this is really interesting. Now, I think this is so cool. I would just be interested to see what the state authorities say about this. And I think that you're going to see maybe some local versus state conflict here. But maybe I'm wrong. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I am interested to see because I think the state law might preempt the city law there, with especially with that six plants. I mean, I can see the everywhere is decriminalizing the possessions, but the six plant thing, this is the first city I've ever heard of actually decriminalizing six plants. Do you know of any other cities done that, Dig?
I can't think of anything. And I think another case study in this, if people don't mind me mentioning, is I remember for a while Austin tried to decriminalize, and the local county law enforcement and stuff started like cracking down and like really messing stuff up there in Austin against the local municipality's wishes. So, you know, shout out to Texas being Texas. So maybe this will go a little different, being that it's in a different part of the country with a lesser tradition of oppressive law enforcement. But we'll see.
Well, I don't know. Missouri's pretty oppressive over that way. I wouldn't say Missouri's some liberal paradise for sure. But I did see a headline this morning that Missouri has surpassed $200 million in medical cannabis sales. Now, Texas hasn't anything close to that, or Alabama either. So I think Arkansas and Missouri, right there in the middle of the kind of up on the northwest side of the South, they're leading the way as far as cannabis legalization goes. But
I would push back a little bit, not to say that Missouri is some liberal paradise, but I think they're in a unique position to understand why cannabis is good for harm reduction. I think the opiate epidemic hit that part of the country really hard, and I think that it changed their understanding of drug and drug policy. And as much as we may have some criticisms for law enforcement, they're products of their local community. So a lot of times it takes a little bit longer for these beliefs to filter into law enforcement. And there still is officer discretion, which I don't like, but a lot more cops are letting people off for stuff like this because it's not what the culture considers a hard substance. So I think that even though we still have a lot of problems with arrests, we still have a lot of things, I think there's also a little room to acknowledge that since all this has happened, the general American attitude toward drugs, I think, is changing. And there's a lot more room for conversation and parsing out the different substances and what their worth is to us as a society, and also what their dangers are.
Yeah, and another interesting thing about Missouri's medical cannabis system is actually a lot of the proceeds and taxes from that go straight into a fund for veterans. So that's a fascinating thing going on there in Missouri. So our next story comes from overseas, and that is in Malta. And Malta actually has legalized cannabis. They are the first ones to do it in Europe. It was thought that Luxembourg was going to be the first one to do it, but that has stalled. But hopefully that will be coming up soon. So let's tell our audience, where is Malta, Dig?
So Malta is an archipelago, which is a group of small islands in the central Mediterranean between Sicily and the North African coast. And if you need a little bit more help, Sicily is the soccer ball that the boot of Italy is kicking.
Yeah, and so they have legalized cannabis. It's not like a sweeping legalization, but they definitely have decriminalized in a lot of ways. So if you're over 18, you can now possess 7 grams and grow 4 plants. And what other things do they do in the Malta law, Dig?
So there's a couple of cool things, right? They're able to cultivate 4 plants at home. They're able to possess 7 grams or 1/4 ounce of cannabis. The only credit, and it's, oh, and here's an interesting feature of the law. It's not 21 and over, it's age 18 and over. So that's an interesting acknowledgement of when the age of consent happens. I think that if we want to make anything 21, we got to make everything 21. And if we're going to make anything 18, we got to make everything 18. I think that that's a cool thing that they're doing. But also, drinking ages and drug consumption ages in Europe are culturally lower than here for a number of reasons. Also, driving isn't as prolific in European countries. So that's probably another feature of those laws you might want to think about.
So it's really great to hear that Malta is legalized, and hopefully more European countries will be following. I think I saw a headline that Germany is going to be right behind. So maybe Germany might beat Luxembourg to it. So we will see. Some medical cannabis going on in Europe, but except for Malta, still nobody has passed the recreational cannabis. So the next article takes us over to the East Coast, and that is in New York. And that is the Mohawk tribe has decided to open up their cannabis system before the state has. And if everybody remembers, there was a law passed. I don't know if it was a law, but it was recognized that because the tribal governments all around the country are their own sovereign countries, that they can go ahead and open up their own medical and recreational cannabis systems. They don't necessarily have to have or abide by the state regulations. So that's what they did at the Mohawk tribe in a town called Aquashoshne. They went ahead and granted 3 cultivation licenses, and they're going ahead and getting this going, Dig.
Yeah, and I think something we talked about before we started the show is that this is showing that if there's a local initiative and there's allowances in the state law, whether you have like tribal land that you have control over that the state can't put its grubby hands on, or you have like a really strong sense of municipality strength and your county can do something ahead of the state, you'll find that if you go ahead and get it going locally, that you can do a faster, better job than the state can. And a lot of times, because you've gone ahead and made a working system, you can try to get grandfathered in under the state system so they can't interfere with your local system as much.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of complaints out of New York as far as the system going slow. It started out, they also allow the counties and city to do the bans where they don't have cannabis shops or businesses. Started out as really low, but then it jumped way up to, I think it was 24% of the cities and towns in New York State and county said no to cannabis. So the tribe is saying, no, we're not going to abide by that, and we're going to go ahead and get this going. And like you said, it just really shows if you really want to open a cannabis system, you can open it fast. You don't need all the crazy regulations. And as we talked about a lot on this show, a lot of the cannabis regulations are just based on the same old things. Everything is usually based on white supremacy, racism, classism, trying to, you know, keep people arrested. You know, also you got the big pharma lobby.
Well, something that people need to consider when everyone's talking about you're not able to consume in public, there's no place to consume in public, is that is classist, because people who own their own property can smoke cannabis wherever they are on their own property. But people who rent are subject to onerous and unfair requirements of their behavior from their landlord. People who, you know, sublet, all that different stuff that people who don't have as much means have to do to secure housing limits their safe and secure and even legal access to cannabis. And that's why we don't need to allow municipalities to limit personal freedom in this regard anymore.
Yeah, we just talked about that last show, how HUD is saying, nope, can't smoke in or use cannabis in a HUD HUD apartment. So, yeah, absolutely, it's classist, and it just sets up an inequitable system, and good on the tribe there in New York for moving forward on this. And that takes us back over here to the West Coast for our final story, and that is out of California, and this one is pretty wild, Dig. To introduce it, the audience may be familiar for what is called the Emerald Cup. And the Emerald Cup goes way back. My first exposure to cannabis, or like California cannabis, was in High Times. And I can remember the Emerald Cup and the Cannabis Cup and these kind of things going on for a long time before I ever even moved out to the West Coast. So these small farmers up there in California have been having these cannabis cups for decades. And this Emerald Cup, I've seen some of my friends out here on the West Coast, they go down to it from time to time. But because of the legalization, this thing has shrunk down from, they said, like 400 local small cannabis farmers. And I don't know if the audience, if anybody has ever experienced really great outdoor grown cannabis, it's just nothing like it. Even outdoor cannabis grown here in Washington, if it's on those big, large scale, it's just nothing like some small farm cannabis. And this, they had 400 vendors, and now this thing has shrunk down to 26, Dig. And even that 26 farmers, they had to negotiate with the state. So let's set the stage here. So tell us first up, what were some of the stipulations that the state put on the farmers just to even have the Emerald Cup? And then we'll get into what happened.
Well, there was a lot of tiered access here, because a retail license in California to actually sell cannabis costs $100,000. So these small farmers were invited to the Emerald Cup, because the Emerald Cup's a little more corporate now than it used to be. They were invited, quote, they offered a lottery allowing 27 small farm cannabis growers the opportunity to present their product at the Cup for a nominal fee. So these people paid a fee to show off their flower at the Emerald Cup. They were not allowed to provide any. They weren't allowed to sell it. Like some, I guess they allow sales at the Emerald Cup, but these people weren't allowed to sell. And then a regulator came in. The Department of Cannabis Control came in and decided that they couldn't display their flower that they had set up to display, so they had to pull it all off. And then the Emerald Cup and a bunch of people had this compromise they reached where the small farmers could become, quote, dispensary employees, and then they could show, like, small personal amounts. But it was a diminished thing, and I'm sure that the Department of Cannabis Control will eventually close that loophole next time. So really kind of a, it would seem, a corporate takeover of corporate cannabis with the Cannabis Cup, but also with the Emerald Cup. But the other thing that people need to realize is these stringent regulatory requirements select for larger, more sophisticated operators. But larger, more sophisticated operators aren't going to prioritize quality flower over profits like these farmers are. So I want to read a quote to you from Mr. O'Neill, one of the farmers here, about this. He said, "You work so hard at something for so long, and it just gets harder and harder for no particular reason. As a vegetable farmer, I pay a nominal fee. I tell the county what crops I grow, and I can sell them at market. But," he said, "cannabis is this never-ending series of these regulatory shifts and drama. One of my life beliefs is to see normalization. To see cannabis regulated under the Department of Cannabis Control is wrong. It shouldn't be about control. It should be about agriculture, because that's what we do as farmers. The reality that farmers are stripped from doing direct market sales is a travesty. It's a fundamentally broken aspect of the regulatory system." And I want to read you folks one more quote, because it's very important that the voices of these small farmers be lifted up so people understand the challenges they face. This is from Wendy Kornberg, who runs Sunnibus Farms in Humboldt County.
Yeah, love that name.
She said, she pointed out that the Emerald Cup used to be hundreds of small cannabis farms. She said, "The Emerald Cup used to be all small farmers. That's all that came. We now have 26 represented in this little group, and another four over there, and maybe four over there." She warned you, this is the death of craft cannabis. If consumers don't get behind it and start demanding something different, and if people don't start getting really loud about the ridiculous regulations that don't do anybody any favors, we support regulation on this show, but we do not support onerous regulation that tips the scales in favor of large, incredulous operators.
Yeah, and that's really what it just all is beginning to look like, is they just want to put the small people out of business, and then they want to come in with the big corporations and take over cannabis. And kind of seeing the same thing trying to happen here in Washington, but going to stick here in California. One of the fascinating things I'm finding about this story is, at the same time this is going on, 2 days later, the headlines just blow up all over. It was just headline after headline after headline. The actual cannabis industry there in California, they are begging for relief from the legislature to try to fix the system. There's so many different things wrong with it. You got overtaxation, you have this environmental rule that you have to have this environmental assessment, which I am an environmentalist. I have a degree in environmental policy. But this legislation, and I'm just going to say it right here on the radio just to be clear, it was made to make a bunch of environmental consultants money, because now every cannabis farmer there in the state has to have an environmental standard, and they have to have a consultant come in and make this big plan. Who does that benefit? It doesn't benefit the state, and it doesn't benefit the cannabis consumer, and it's just fascinating.
They're still not doing anything to make anything safe, right? They're not testing runoffs from these farms. They're just testing stuff and offering vague plans, but they're not testing the runoff. There are a lot of times, does Washington even test for mold?
No, Washington does not test for mold, but California probably does. But another thing about the California thing is that they are just, you know, one of the things that we keep seeing is they're such in desperate straits. Dispensaries are suing cities for not busting drug dealers, Dick. And then on top of that. And then let's add to that, and I'm just mentioning that because of the big mess. Let's add to it the story after we see constantly how the underground market is actually taking over Northern California and Oregon. And these small cannabis farmers in the Emerald Cup, the DCC, the Department of Cannabis Control, they just see them as drug dealers. But they're not. They're just farmers.
Wait. So there's what's going on in Oregon is a little bit different than what's going on in California. I think what's going on in Oregon also goes in California, but what we're seeing in Oregon largely with the illicit, the large scale illicit cultivation, that flower is not competing with Oregon flower on the Oregon market. It's going away. It's going east. It's going elsewhere. So I don't know how much pressure those illicit operators are actually putting on the legal market in Oregon. I am skeptical of that because from what I understand, all these big outlaw grows, all that stuff is going out, overseas or back east. And when I say back east, I mean somewhere where it's illegal back east, you know, Texas, wherever, I don't know, back east. The royal eat back east. And I think that's going on in California too, but I do think that there's a lot more room in California's system for illegal flower to filter its way into more Californians' hands.
Yeah.
But the systems in the two states are very different. There's a lot more room in the legal Oregon market for flower to move around legally and not need to be illegal.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, California, they're just, I guess my whole point with bringing all that up is the cannabis system along in the underground system is helping it, the overregulation is helping it, all of it kind of mixed up together is just creating this big, massive, it just looking like California's botched their cannabis system.
Yeah, it's one of the worst markets out there, from what I understand. But I haven't spent too much time down there, so I can't speak to it on an experiential level. But I hear that it's almost impossible to compete in the legal market if you're an up and up operator, unless you just have like you're benefiting from markets of scale, right? If you're like a 26 store operator, then you can ride the wave of volatility in the market a little bit better than if you're a mom and pop, like a vertically integrated farm to table dispensary.
So we'll see what happens with California. I haven't seen any kind of hint where the legislature says they're going to help out or anything. I don't really know what they would do. They've already tried to crack down on all the illegal market. They've tried all kind of different things. So, and they don't seem like they would want to get rid of that environmental rule. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens coming up in California. And now let's get on to our guest. And this week we have on Robert Beasley. And we are back on the Cannabis Corner. My name is Lucas Barfield. We are joined today by Robert Beasley, who is the CEO of Fluent, who is a multi-state dispensary operator, but they are based in Florida. And we're going to be talking to Robert about a couple different issues, cannabis in Florida, federal cannabis banking, and some other things. How are you doing today, Robert?
Hello, I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, it is great to have you on the show, and I wanted to touch base with you really quick. How did you get into the cannabis industry, and how did you get become CEO of Fluent?
It's kind of a long-winded story, but the short version is that I was a practicing lawyer in the state of Florida, and through one group or another, I was asked to participate in the drafting and commentary of the constitutional amendment, and then following, I participated in the statutory development, and then following that, commentary in the regulatory development. Following that course, when the first few licenses were issued in Florida, I became kind of a shoe-in for a advisor, purely from a legal point of view, on advising into what these words meant. As I continued as a consultant advisor, I became more and more involved in the operational aspects, involved in the credit facilities and the investment group aspects, and kind of worked my way through and became on the board of managers for one of the first of the five licensees in Florida. We ultimately brought that company through the cultivation, the processing, the retail, and then that company sold to another national Canadian company at the time. And that kind of set me off. I ended up going from state to state, developing up companies as, you know, the big idea is to get a license. Well, once you get a license, that's just a piece of paper that entitles you for the long-winded burden of producing several hundred million dollars, possibly, of capital and a couple of years of hard work. And so that's the part that I would do. Ultimately, in 2019, Fluent called me to come in as an advisor, and I stayed as an advisor on helping them reorganize their business model from about January 20 until I was asked to take the chair of CEO in September of 20, and I've been the CEO since.
Yeah, thanks for that. And I want to jump right into the questions, and I wanted to ask you, since you are the CEO of a dispensary chain, and there just are some stories out right now over in California, and we are continually seeing this sort of strife between the medical cannabis community and the adult use that's coming in. What are some of the differences that you see there as the head of a multi-state dispensary chain that serves medical cannabis patients? What are some of the differences that you see between adult use cannabis and medical cannabis?
So the differentiation between those two categories is different from state to state. In Florida, we do not have such a differentiation because there's no difference. There's not a recreational state. In those states, when you start to see a recreational program come in, what's left of the medical program is typically centered around dosage. You usually have a higher dosage allotment in medical programs. It's also centered around price, which relates to sometimes size and dosage size, but also taxes. Sometimes the programs that are medical remain a tax-free transaction. But ultimately, and then sometimes from a sales point of view, the product line, product lines that are medical in nature usually remain pretty high in the CBD content. CBD is a functional component as an anti-inflammatory of most medical treatments. But also you see different formulations and ratios in the medical-based product. I would suffice to say that a rec-based or adult-use product really focuses on THC concentration and starts to go towards those high-concentrate items and high-concentrate product lines. A lot of those concentrate product lines are not necessarily appropriate for medical use.
Being a multi-state operator, like you said, and I think that I saw that you're in Florida, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Texas, and those are all very different states. How does Fluent keep the patient first in your model, considering what you mentioned, all the different regulatory schemes?
So we are operating in states that have adult use, Michigan being one of them. Florida is medical. Texas is medical. In Pennsylvania, although there's been much talk about it, still remains medical. So we have the privilege right now of operating in a pretty medical-based market. As such, you know, you see our product offerings that are really catered and tuned in to what the prescribing physicians are looking for. What we do is we do a lot of research. We stay on the cusp of the condition that's offered in that state and then what the appropriate formulations are for the conditions. One of the frustrating things in an evolving state like Texas is, you know, the legislature just passed their act. We were hoping for a 10% concentration. The political compromise was a 1%. Okay, we can live with that. But then they expanded the conditions. And so now you have this misfitting scenario where you have conditions that are available for treatment, but not sufficient dosage for that treatment. And so we have to really struggle to make sure that if you have a condition that you're eligible, that we're able to provide you a dosage format or a product formulation format that meets your condition. It would be as if you could only take one Advil, regardless of your condition. And so that's the big struggle in making sure that the medical need is met.
You kind of touched on it just a little bit, but what are some of the major challenges that you're facing in operating in different states? And then can you just talk real quick about if the federal government were to pass some banking relief and deschedule cannabis and maybe change some of the federal laws, how would that help some of those challenges that you mentioned?
Yeah, and those all kind of relate to each other. So the biggest challenge is that they are independent silos. In any other business where you're a multi-state operator, you would get some of the efficiencies of scale. we may have a piece of equipment in Michigan. This isn't hypothetical. We have a piece of equipment in Michigan that we would really like to use occasionally in Florida, but we're not able to move things across state lines because of the regulatory environment. Of course, we cannot move any product across state lines. And so the fact that we may have a robust inventory on our shelves in Pennsylvania does us no good in Florida. And so the fact that you have to set up essentially independent companies requires a good bit of duplication and of the efforts. You know, you end up having to have separate companies within your companies. The second issue that makes it more difficult is the regulatory environment. You know, there are a lot of similar rules, but in a lot of ways, the rules related to packaging and advertising and so forth are completely different. And so we have to end up with different teams. And therefore, the company cannot be one unified company. It has to be several companies in one. Now, these changes you just mentioned, one of which is access to banking. You know, we are still operating as if we're a criminal enterprise. We do not have any access to the federal banking system, which means a lot of the banking functions that businesses use for efficiency, we do not have access to. It does drive us towards an all-cash type business. Moving cash is difficult and quite frankly, unsafe. But that's the situation we're forced into. More importantly to us than that, it would be access to the credit system. We would be able to obtain capital at reasonable rates as opposed to private capital. Private money always costs more. The federal wire system, we'd be able to move and pay vendors through the ACH or wires. We're not allowed to do that. And then the access to other types of transactions. When you're disqualified from the federal banking system, you're also disqualified from a whole host of things that you don't even think about. The various labor programs, for instance, all of agriculture in this country is supported by the legalized immigrant labor programs, in which, you know, people coming from elsewhere have the opportunity under a work visa to provide for their families and provide a lot of the work that otherwise doesn't get done in this country. And agriculture is hard work, and cannabis agriculture is no different. But we're not allowed to access any of those programs because we are still federally illegal. So the Safe Banking Act, which has again failed to pass or failed to make it through the process, would have been a tremendous relief to our industry. The second relief would have been a descheduling, which is, there's, you know, at this point, there's no real mention of that anymore. But the descheduling itself would allow us access to those federal programs. And then the big one, the descheduling would allow us to get out of what they call the 280E exemption, which causes our effective tax rate to be in the 60%.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned the immigrants. We've reported a lot on the Cannabis Corner about over here on the West Coast, a lot of cannabis producers, usually underground cannabis producers, that are using illegal immigrants to do their harvesting and everything like that. And we've always talked about how bringing everybody into the fold would help out with that. It would be a lot less exploitation of workers if you kind of made cannabis more illegal, like you were talking about, on a federal level, would open up some of those immigration programs. So really glad to hear that being talked about on the federal level. So I want to kind of get back and talk about Florida. I'm an Alabama native, but I spent a lot of time in Florida, and we've talked about Florida a lot on the show, and I do a fair amount of reporting on Florida. So what is going on in Florida with the medical cannabis? I know they're talking about, they just had a conviction of a large dispensary chain's husband got convicted in a corruption case, and then we find out that he had something to do with this 30-year rule that is in Florida. Can you talk a little bit about Florida's medical cannabis system specifically, and do you think they're going to start opening it up a little bit more so we can get in some more licensees down there?
You mentioned that issue with Kim Rivers and her husband, and I'm not sure, you know, it's unfortunate for her, and I'm not sure that that has anything to do with the industry or the process of the industry or its progression. I think what is more relevant to it is the position of the governor's office. I cannot say that the governor is against cannabis, but he is certainly not supportive of development of the program. You know, the Department of Health is in the executive department as an agency, and as such, it is, you know, controlled entirely from directives from the governor. A secretary position appointed by the governor or secretary of health obviously is in control of that department and agency. And so its momentum is entirely dictated by the executive. what we have seen is a very lagging, slow pace. And at this point, it's clearly intentional. You know, we've hit a lot of statutory benchmarks. The licensure allowance, when it hit 600,000, should have allowed for more. There have been benchmarks prior to that, which the Department of Health should have moved forward. And they have not. They have had several pieces of litigation that could have been resolved that were not. And it's kind of just dragging them through the mud to get them to do anything. That pace, or that tone, if you would, is driven by the executive. So the short answer is, we're going to have to wait to the gubernatorial elections and that outcome before we see any real movement. The department has now said they're going to open up the Pigford license, but that we are going to do the Pigford license first and then open up the remainder of the licenses after the 600,000 patient benchmark. There's no reason to do that. There's no reason that they need to do that one then the other. But the likelihood is that the Pigford license, that single license, is going to result in litigation. And I expect to see the department shut down again and say, well, we're going to wait for that litigation to be completed until we do anything further. So you see this very slow tectonic movement where a department is reluctantly satisfying their statutory obligations. That can only be a directive from the executive.
Yeah, and for the audience, the Pigford cases are a group of cases having to do with the USDA and black farmers in general, but the Florida legislature used the opportunity to say that the state was going to give out one black farmer one cannabis medical cannabis license, and then they just said they were going to do that. They're opening up the license window in March for like 5 days. So like you said, the whole process is so convoluted and messed up, there's certainly going to be lawsuits. And, I think it's just going to drag on for a long time. And then that kind of gets us to another story that I just saw. And this is kind of hot off the presses. I've been seeing this story coming up with people. They had a breakout of a lot of people using spice, which is a artificial cannabinoid down in Florida, which has nothing to do with medical cannabis, except that one of the headlines, somebody came out and said that they were using the spice because the medical cannabis was too high in Florida, so the cost was too high. I've done a couple stories on how the cost of medical cannabis is too high in Florida. Do you want to address the high prices of medical cannabis in Florida real quick while you're on the show?
Sure. And I will say that there's nothing artificial about the pricing. The fact is that, as I indicated to you before, when these companies received the golden ticket, you know, it was an invitation to spend $50 to $100 million. You had to deploy. The result of the vertical nature in Florida is that, unlike any other company, you have to be an agricultural company, you have to be a processing company, you have to be a packaging company, you have to be a logistics company, and then you have to be a full retail company. Those multidisciplinary aspects of the company causes the cost of entry to be extremely high. Agriculture itself is an expensive endeavor. The processing equipment is very specialized. And so what you have is a company that, in order to put the product on the shelf day one, has already, you know, they've already got $50 to $60 million in it. Then compare that to also the principle of scarcity. You know, we are still underserved in canopy space in Florida. Because of the cost of construction, even the big companies like Trulieve, you know, they've slowly continued to build canopy space. But the fact is that demand still outstrips supply. So basic economics, anytime you have demand outstripping supply, you're going to have pricing, increased pricing. That is being alleviated as these bigger players come in and as some of these mergers have taken place over the last year. Everyone's focused on putting more production on the ground. Because we're vertical, we cannot buy it from anywhere else, which means we got to grow it to sell it. So you got to start at the bottom of the pyramid and invest in your canopy. Increasing your canopy helps you get more product on the shelves. Well, as everyone does that, then supply goes up and pricing will start to compress. I expect that to occur. But it's, you know, there's nothing nefarious about it. It's just bare, simple economics. You put $100 million into a business, you're going to want to charge something to start getting a return on that money so that you can pay the debts that you just incurred. And that at its very basic level is the driver.
So I want to really talk real quick about, some of your operations specifically. And I saw that you helped, work on some of the cultivation operations there for Fluent. So just let's talk about real quick what goes into opening up one of these large cultivation facilities, what kind of equipment you're using, and how long does it take to kind of build one of these from start to finish, and what goes into it?
It takes about a year under good conditions, and I would say that the last 2 years our conditions have been terrible. You know, I am still sitting with major components. We started a facility in May of 21, and we're nearing completion, but for the fact that we have major components, we have grow tables on a ship somewhere in Holland. We have some controller equipment that's somewhere in China that's never left the ports over there. And so the worldwide shipping and supply chain issues, as they've been labeled, that they impact us as well. But they impact us a little extra because all of the equipment and everything we're using is specialized. And so it, you know, there's not an opportunity to go down to the Ace Hardware or the Home Depot and pick up some of the materials and equipment that we need to produce this product. And so that puts a strain on the development. And that strain is what you've seen starting to grind down the progress of some of these canopies from being enhanced and expanded. So basically, you know, you're growing. Florida is not a very friendly outdoor space for cannabis. In fact, cannabis doesn't naturally grow here. It doesn't like wet feet, first of all. Mm. And the humidity does not allow for the bud to grow in a way that is mold-free. So if you grow cannabis outside in Florida, you're almost 90% chance going to have mold in it. Now, that mold isn't necessarily that harmful for you, except that the state of Florida's standards are so strict that we're almost in a zero-tolerance scenario. So we're growing in a state that the cannabis itself doesn't want to grow in because of the mold and the humidity, and then we're being judged by a zero-tolerance scenario. What that means is that you have to put a lot of environmentals into the grow, meaning utilities. So, you know, looking at a facility, an average-sized facility, our power bill is $65,000 a month, every month, and that's usually climate control. And so you have to develop a facility, even if you use a greenhouse, you have to develop a greenhouse that has sufficient environmental controls to control humidity. And that's the key to growing in Florida.
Yeah, and you really touched on the issue there on the environmental impact of large-scale growing, and it's just another reason to open up federal legalization, because we keep hearing that Oregon has a glut of cannabis, they're growing too much cannabis in California. People would say the same thing about Washington State a lot of times. You know, if we would open it up federally, we could easily just import large amounts of cannabis to Florida and maybe cut down on some of those large indoor facilities, and then reduce your power bills, reduce energy consumption. And there's just a whole bunch of dominoes that would fall if we could get this federal legalization. But I want to get out of here with you telling us, how can people find out more about Fluent, and is there anything exciting coming up your way with medical cannabis?
Absolutely. First of all, you can go to getfluent.com, www.getfluent.com. Our ticker on the Canadian exchange is TIUM. The holding company is called Consortium, and the last four letters are TIUM. And you can find that on the exchange and hopefully buy some shares, because we are publicly traded. As for new and exciting, we have, you know, we're starting to get into the syrups and concentrates. In the next month and a half, we'll start rolling out the shatters, the butters and the crumbles, and a lot of those high concentrate products. I was at a presentation yesterday where we're starting up our butane extractor, which is a solventless portion of extraction using butane. It's just become legal in Florida to be able to do that. What that does is increase our efficiencies of extraction and allow us to get into these high concentrate products. And so I think you'll see us in the next 2 months bringing online a lot of those higher concentrate products that are desired at this point by the consumers. Also, we have closed off and finished the production of our 11 grow room facility in Sweetwater. That is specifically our small batch artisanal flower. We've had a couple of really great rollouts. We rolled out some 28% sour diesel the other day. We've got some Gary Payton that just came out. And so we're allowing those strains that have great genetic potential to realize that potential. And so one of the things you'll see from us and others, admittedly, is the quality of flower is starting to increase in Florida. You know, Florida for a lot of times sold a moderate volume of moderate quality flower throughout the system. And that's not just us, that's everybody. And you're seeing that flower quality start to turn up as these new facilities come online. And we're proud to say that our facility is now in full production. And so we should have a full complement of flowering offerings on our shelves from here on out.
All right. So now we're going to get into our It's a Bust segment, and that is the last segment of our show. And in this segment, we look at the drug war and the effect on people by the police and their continued assault on cannabis consumers out there across the country. And we are staying in the South. The past two we've done in the South, and we're going to stay there. And this one is in Texas. I believe it was Alice, Texas. Someone was busted with 24 plants, and I really was kind of disturbed how this came about. It was actually a Crime Stoppers tip, and then the police came, knocked on the door, opened the door, smelled cannabis. They didn't say smoke or whether it was actually the plants, but another police officer went and looked through the window and saw cannabis paraphernalia and cannabis on a table. Then they went and got their warrant. And by the way, we're not going to mention their names, but both men had Spanish-sounding names. So then there's that, the continued racist drug war is still going on in Texas. So just another sad case out of Texas. And how many plants they find when they actually got the warrant and went in there, Dick?
They seized 24 plants and 5 vacuum-sealed bags of processed cannabis. So it sounds like a little home grow, and they were saving some for later. They were probably trying to blow it up real quick, get a bunch of cannabis and then hide it and then have some to smoke at home. And these, you know, cops busted them based on a tip from someone in the neighborhood, I guess. And I want to mention that also there's this weird feature in the article alongside growing equipment and a, quote, cannabis Bible, quote. It's really interesting that they put the cannabis Bible in quotes. It's almost like they're trying to trigger the theocrats in Texas to get them all excited. Oh, it's a Bible. It's just a grow guide. That's what growers call a grow guide. So it's just interesting, some of the little quotations and the way stuff is annotated in this article that are different than you might see elsewhere in the country.
Yeah, because the anti-cannabis folks they're getting really fired up right now. Did an article recently with the governor of Nebraska, is working with anti-cannabis groups. But what was really disturbing about that is, right about that same time, I noticed there was a really large uptick in Nebraska cannabis bust. It was going on for 2 weeks. I was like, what the heck's going on in Nebraska? But then we see the governors coming out against cannabis because they're trying to get medical cannabis in Nebraska. So it's just really disturbing, and it's... I don't want to say fascinating, but it's interesting. So you got the 24 plants in Texas. You know, that sounds like a lot, but it's not really a lot on an indoor scale.
It's very small.
Yeah. But they're growing, so the medical cannabis in Texas can be up to 5% THC. I mean, so they're growing cannabis in Texas. It's not really high strong, but then you're going to come over here and you're going to bust these guys for cannabis. It's just... And we were talking about this last, it's a bust, how the psilocybin is going through the roof, but then they're still busting people. It's just something we really need to get this, I think federal legalization is going to be the key to get all this sort of straightened out, Dig.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's good. There's going to be a lot more police violence before we're done. And they're warning us, right? They're saying, oh, give me $25 million here in Oregon here. Give me this here in California. The legal market's crying for a crackdown. And what's going to happen is, yeah, they'll bust some illicit operators. But they'll also use it as an excuse to harass citizens and make people's lives harder unnecessarily. Because that's what the carceral state does.
So that is the end of our show. My name is Lucas Barfield. If you would like to get in touch with me, you can email info@radiotacoma.org and they will get the message over there to me. We will have our own dedicated email address coming up soon. And how can people get in touch with you, Dig?
Yeah, you can follow me on Instagram @UncleDig. You can also listen to my podcast wherever you get podcasts. The podcast is called The Bagseed Chronicles and I host it. We'll be right back.
This is Cannabis Corner, hosted by Lucas Barfield. If you would like to get in contact with your host, he is on Twitter at MJIsMedicine. Your musical selection is The Happy Monster by Chubby Jackson and his orchestra, recorded on 78 in 1947. You can find this music and much more at The Great 78 Project, an archive of historical music recordings at great78.archive.org. You are listening to 101.9 KTAH, Radio Tacoma.